Should I just start? Okay. All right. Hello. Welcome to PolitiFest 2024. Can our government meet the moment? First session of the day. Yeah. All right. I'm Bella Ross. I am the social media producer for Voice of San Diego. It's really awesome to be here today. My first time working at PolitiFest. So it's going to be good. In case you're not familiar with us, Voice of San Diego is an investigative nonprofit. Our whole goal is to hold public officials accountable and give you guys the information you need to be advocates for yourself and for the government, or for your communities. As a nonprofit, we do depend on members and donors and sponsors to make our work possible. So we really appreciate you guys being here and supporting us. I would like to take a minute to recognize our sponsors who helped make this event possible. A special thanks to the College of Arts and Sciences at the University of San Diego for being our partner for the 7th year now. Our thanks also to the Sequon Band of the Kumeyaay Nation, the United Domestic Workers Union, AARP, the San Diego Foundation, Business for Good, Hiche Development, the San Diego Municipal Employees Association, the Asian Business Association, Planned Parenthood of the Pacific Southwest, Atlantis Group, San Diego Art Matters, and the Southern California Rental Housing Association. We'd also like to recognize KPBS and iNewsSource, our partners in public matters. We are all partnering this election season and beyond to share content and hopefully stimulate a conversation, such as we are doing today, to hopefully motivate people to get involved in their communities and get involved in the democratic process and better understand how all of that stuff works. So if you're unable to attend any of these sessions in person, I'm speaking into this microphone. There are people listening from afar, tuning into live streams. We will be posting these recordings on the PolitiFest page on our website next week. We welcome your questions. Myself and Brendan over here are going to be going around throughout the session, handing out note cards and pens. So flag us down at any time if you want to write down a question. I'll be taking them up here. And then at the end, last 15 minutes or so, we will have time for those. And then you can tweet along with the session and share your experience at hashtag PolitiFest2024, Instagram, Facebook, and X/Twitter. And so I'm going to introduce our moderator, finally hand it off. This is Will Huntsbury, Senior Investigative Reporter for Voice of San Diego. And we're going to be having a conversation about Prop 47 slash Prop 36. Enjoy.
Is this the slide guy?
Yeah.
Nice. Okay. So welcome everybody. We got some great guests. I'm gonna introduce them in just one second. But first, I want to just give us a quick little primer on what we're talking about today, which is Prop 36. But that kind of goes back to 2014 and Prop 47. So Prop 47 was passed in 2014, and it reduced penalties for theft and drug possession. It was a big deal at the time. People thought it was a really great idea. Now it seems a fair amount of people have changed their minds about that. And so with Prop 47, the specifics of it, California's prisons were once very, very, very overcrowded. And part of what Prop 47 was trying to do was make sure that people were only in prison for the most serious and violent felonies. And so one thing Prop 47 did, you've probably heard about this in the news a lot, it increased the threshold for felony theft to $950. It had been about half that, but it raised it so that the person had to steal that much or more to be able to be charged with a felony. And it also made drug possession a misdemeanor in almost all cases. So that was Prop 47 that passed in 2014. Now, this year, on this year's ballot, you're going to be asked whether you want to roll some of those things back or not. And that's Proposition 36, that you'll be answering that question on. And what Prop 36 does is it increases punishment for theft and drug crimes. It doesn't roll back all the parts of Prop 47, but it rolls back quite a bit of them. And some of the specifics on Prop 36, it gets rid of that $950 threshold if a person has two previous theft-related convictions. So not on your first time or your second time, but your third time, you could be charged with a felony for stealing less than that. It increases sentences up to 3 years if people steal in a group. You know, we've seen that on the news a lot, these crime rings. Supposedly, I think we'll get into talk about whether that's been overblown or not, but we've certainly seen examples of it on the news. Convictions for selling certain drugs, really hard drugs like fentanyl and heroin, the sentences can be longer. And those sentences would have to be served in prison instead of jail in some cases. Some people with past drug convictions, if they're caught possessing multiple times, they could be charged with a treatment mandated felony. And so they would either have to accept treatment or they could get a felony for drug possession. So it would bring back felony drug possession charges in some cases. Prop 36 would also require courts to inform people convicted of selling certain drugs that they could be charged with murder if somebody dies from them selling fentanyl to that person. And the Legislative Analyst's Office has said this would increase costs to taxpayers. It's a little unclear how much. They said it could be tens of millions of dollars to hundreds of millions of dollars. It depends on how many people end up going back to prison. And it also depends how prosecutors handle it. And we have a prosecutor on the panel today, fortunately, who's going to help us understand some of this stuff. I'm going to take a seat now and introduce these guys.
Is this on? Yeah, great.
To my far right, Genevieve Jones Wright. She is the founding executive director of Community Advocates for Just and Moral Governance. I believe they call it MoGov. And it works to advance the rights of marginalized people in the community. Genevieve has been a major voice for criminal justice reform in this community, as I'm sure you all know. She previously ran for district attorney. And we also have Pat Espinoza up here. He is the chief deputy district attorney, and he has been at the DA's office for 29 years. And he manages five different divisions: Superior Court, Sex Crimes and Human Trafficking, Gangs, Narcotics, and the Insurance Fraud and Workplace Justice Division. And he also supervises the DA's legislation unit. So let's get into it, guys. Thank you so much for being here today.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you for having us. Appreciate it. Pat, I want to start with you. The Public Policy Institute for California, they've looked at this question of shoplifting and how much it's increased or not. In the state, since 2019, there has been an increase in shoplifting, according to PPIC. But in San Diego, since 2019, shoplifting is down 21%. So why should San Diegans support this measure?
Well, first of all, this is a statewide measure. So I think we're looking at it from the aspect of Californians. And when you look at the numbers, if you're looking at San Diego-specific numbers, you have to understand some of the impacts of Prop 47. And what Prop 47 did was it reduced many thefts so that they were misdemeanors. And the issue with misdemeanors, that before we could have someone had multiple thefts, then the future thefts could be charged as felonies. And that change was made in Prop 47. So now when a police officer goes and tries to make an arrest on someone who may have committed a series of misdemeanor thefts, now the tools on police have changed because it would be a misdemeanor arrest rather than a felony arrest. And by that, now officers cannot enter a non-felony arrest if it didn't occur in their presence, And so now what they have to do is they have to do issue a citation, a cite and release. And so that's basically giving them a ticket for shoplifting, no matter how many times they shoplift. And the problem is this, is that those folks who get that cite and release, what we notice is they're not coming to court. And so when they blow off that citation, they don't come to court and they have one, two, three, four, five shoplifting offenses. Those cases don't go to court. They're not arraigned. They don't go through the criminal justice process and they don't end up with a conviction. And so that's why there's been an impact on the data. And also because the thefts are no longer felony theft cases, they're now misdemeanor theft cases. The problem is those are now lower priorities. What we know here in San Diego is we have vacancies in filling our law enforcement officers in terms of deputy sheriff's vacancies, police officer vacancies. And so they have to respond with limited resources on a priority. And so if there is a felony offense that's reported, you know, someone calls it in, the police are going to respond to felony crimes and then go down according to resources before they can respond to misdemeanor offenses. The other issue is, frankly, the level of theft is such that the retailers, they're not calling the police. They're simply, in some sense, given up. That's where any one of you, if you walk in, if you go into the Target in Mission Valley, you walk down a couple aisles, you will see the merchandise is behind a locked glass case. That's very different than things were years ago prior to Prop 47. That's because the retailers and the mom and pop businesses, they've saying things are a crisis now and we have to do something differently. The interesting thing is the governor himself went to Target. It was in the Sacramento area, and he saw individuals shoplift and the workers weren't doing anything. And he had a conversation with the cashier and he said, "Why don't you do something? Why don't you call police?" And the cashier, not knowing it was the governor of the state of California there, said, "Oh, because the governor changed the limit and it allows this to happen." Now, that wasn't accurate.
But the governor does not support Prop 36, right?
That's true. But in this case, he was telling this story during Prop 1 when it came up. And he was sharing this anecdote and said, "That is not the case. You know, you guys need to report that." But that's just an example of how many of these retailers, they just, you know, they give it up on reporting a lot of those cases. And so getting back to your point, a lot of that data is that we're looking to doesn't reflect the seriousness of the theft issue that we're experiencing in San Diego and statewide.
Well, I have some follow-ups, but I want to let you get in there, Genevieve. What do you think when you hear that?
So there was a lot there, and a lot of it is not true. And I want to be very clear. Before Prop 47 ever was passed by us, Californians, by 60%, you had people who were opposed to Prop 47, like law enforcement agencies, district attorneys across the state, and retailers who were hell-bent on their plan B if it did pass. And their efforts have been to repeal Prop 47 and never give it a chance. So when I hear that police officers can't arrest, it's untrue. There is a lack of will on the part of law enforcement because they have a point to make and they want to blame Prop 47. So the question talked about how crime trends are down for San Diego. Property crimes are down in San Diego. Shoplifting crimes are down in San Diego. And what we just heard in response was, if you go to Mission Valley Target, these things are encased because of this. Those things don't correlate now, do they? So let's talk about how we have been hyped on hysteria by the retail lobby and correctional officers and district attorneys and law enforcement officers, and they have created, manufactured a crisis that is simply not true. And I can get into that a little bit later. But what I want to say is this. There is nothing that prevents a police officer from arresting someone for engaging in petty theft or shoplifting. There is nothing that prevents a district attorney right now today from taking all of the petty thefts that Mr. Espinosa just talked about someone doing and aggregating them and putting them in one case and charging that as grand theft and making it a felony. Prop 47 does not stand as a barrier to any of those things. So in this conversation, I want us to be clear on the facts and not on things that have been put in front of us so that we can become angered or frustrated and say ridiculous things like we should be locking up criminals and not laundry detergent. Because I am here to tell you that the people who are stealing laundry detergent need it and they don't have the money. So it's not about giving them prison because of an economic crime because they're poor. It is about getting to the heart of why you would need to steal laundry detergent in the first place. And that is what Prop 36 does not address.
So, Genevieve, we'll stick with you for a minute. Shoplifting is down in San Diego, as we talked about, because of the numbers in four counties. It's up statewide, according to PPIC. You know, some people who support this measure, they're saying we're not rolling back all parts of Prop 47. You know, you would need to have two previous theft convictions, or you'd need to have previous drug convictions. They say they're just working back towards the middle on this, and it's not so as extreme as getting rid of everything. What do you say to that?
They're not working back to the middle, Will. We're talking about going back to failed policies. We can recall the impact on communities with the failed war on drugs, and this is exactly what Prop 36 is bringing us back to. This is a step backwards for California. When you're talking about giving prison to people who have substance abuse disorders, this is what we were doing during the war on drugs. And where did that lead us to? It led us to overpopulated prisons that we were operating in California at nearly double capacity, to the point that the United States Supreme Court said, do something about it because you are violating people's Eighth Amendment right against cruel and unusual punishment. Prop 47 came on the heels of that decision. So we're not talking about going to the middle. We are talking about pushing the pendulum back to where we incarcerate and over-incarcerate people and ignore real solutions and put people in prison for things that we should be solving as elected officials, hello, local government, district attorneys. Where's the accountability, right? I will end this answer to this question with this. Prop 36 says that it will give mandated treatment to folks who need it. How? Somebody ask that question, please.
Thank you, Genevieve. Okay, we'll go back to you now, Pat. Genevieve brought this up. You mentioned in your first answer that there's a question of law enforcement resources here, you said, and that if we push these things back to felonies, then that will kind of give law enforcement the I'm not exactly sure how you would describe it, the motivation they need to actually go out on these calls in a way that they're not now. But, you know, I guess I'll put Genevieve's question to you. Why can't they prioritize this now if someone can be sentenced up to 6 months in jail for a misdemeanor theft?
There are two issues here. There's one, there's the theft issue, and then there's the drug issue. And so you're speaking specifically about the theft issue. Why can't they prioritize that? I mean, one of the issues, I think I mentioned this, was, well, they have to be notified first. And we have retailers who aren't calling the police, and that's not coming to the police's attention.
We know that I've done stories about people downtown who call the police. The police don't necessarily show up. Is part of the reason they've stopped calling because the police aren't coming, unless it's just like, I mean, I've heard stories of people in, you know, a corner store downtown saying, like, I told the cops there was a knife involved just so they'd hurry up and get there.
Right. Well, and also what we saw it occurred in Sacramento County was the target area in Sacramento, they were calling the police every time this happened. And the response from the city attorney in that city was to threaten them with being the target to be charged for the crime of public nuisance for continuing to call. And so in part of the legislative package, the bills that were signed in AB 2943, one element of that law, crazily enough, was they changed the law so that city attorneys cannot charge retailers or threaten to charge them with public nuisance for reporting retail theft. So, I mean, it is an issue, not just in San Diego, but statewide, where, you know, they're just resource starved and they can't respond to all. Now,
how can we fix that? Will this proposition fix that?
Well, what this proposition will do, it will focus on not all people who commit thefts, but the small individuals who commit numerous serial thefts. Because the way it works is if you have documented petty theft convictions, then the future petty theft that is committed becomes a felony, becomes a more of a priority for police. And it really is. I mean, it's an issue of limited resources and what we're asking our law enforcement officers to respond to. And what this says, it says, let's not make every petty theft a felony. That's going too far. Let's focus on that small minority of theft offenders that continue to do it despite, you know, being convicted and being convicted again. Those folks, those are the ones that are going to be looking at, felony offenses that will give the law enforcement more tools so that when they go in, they can make the arrest even if the crime didn't occur in front of the police. They can make the arrest now if, they have, for example, there's been a change in the law now that would allow them to make the arrest if it occurred on videotape and was not in the immediate presence of the police officer. So some of these rules that exist that limit an officer's ability to make a misdemeanor arrest would be solved by having it be elevated to a felony. And so that's the response that would allow the police officers to prioritize.
So would you support a change like that, Genevieve, where it makes it easier for an officer to do a misdemeanor arrest if they have videotape evidence in that case?
Absolutely. And I think we're already there. And that's the other part that we have to consider when we talk about Prop 36 and whether it's necessary. The answer is it's not. It's overkill. Prop 36 is not being placed in front of you or me in a vacuum. We live in a state where our governor just signed a slate of legislation. We have our legislative body who just passed in the teens laws that directly impact organized retail crime and the things that Prop 36 seeks to address. So when I hear Mr. Espinosa talk about how now police officers don't have to be a witness to a theft crime in order to make an arrest, I'm happy to hear that, because guess what? That is one of the changes. But I can also tell you this, that has been the law as it relates to misdemeanors, period. Not just theft offenses. That has just been what it was in California, that someone can't just tell a police officer, you committed a crime and it is a misdemeanor, and that officer who did not see you commit the crime can arrest you. So that is status quo. Now we have legislation that says an officer, after looking at surveillance footage, and it is clear who that person is, can be arrested. So we're not considering Prop 36 in a vacuum. And this is what voters need to understand. The things that Prop 36 is striving to do is actually regress us back and move us to a place where we wanted to move from. And so we will be moving backwards. And the other thing that I wanted to make sure that I stated was there is no data to support that retailers or retail stores are not reporting crime. There's absolutely no data to support that at all. The data shows that law enforcement is not responding to the calls. Now, whether or not that ends up being a chicken and the egg problem where retailers are saying, I'm not calling because you're not showing up, I will tell you that I haven't seen an article or any data that actually supports that retailers are not calling the police. The other thing that I wanted to make sure that I mentioned and addressed was that even when people are given citations for theft or property crimes and they don't show up, law enforcement still have this thing called bench warrants that they can ask judges for. And judges can actually issue them and say, in the system, there's going to be a warrant for this person's arrest, and you can pick them up on that warrant given these conditions. So I really want to make sure that when we're having this conversation about what has happened since Prop 47, that we are talking about reality. And Will, I really hope we get to the benefits of Prop 47.
Okay. Patrick, I'll give you a chance to respond to that first, if you want.
Well, I think she's speaking about citizens' arrests, and that is true. You can have an officer can have a citizen arrest for a misdemeanor that occurs outside the officer's presence. But the problem is, you have to have a citizen who's willing to sign their name and say, you know, I agree to participate in the prosecution. And that citizen who sees the theft at Target has to wait around until the police show up and then say, go to the officer, the officer find them and say, are you willing to sign this as a citizen's arrest because the misdemeanor did not occur in my presence? And so and that's one of the issues that we've heard law enforcement express about the ability and the frustration how a lot of the thefts that occur don't get reported. It was mentioned earlier that, you know, on the narcotics aspect of this proposition is, you know, whether it's a war on drugs. It's not. It's a war on addiction. It's a war on addiction because someone who is in possession, simple possession of a drug, it would still be a misdemeanor the first time. It would still be a misdemeanor the second time. And what we've seen, because these drug offenses are now treated as misdemeanors when they used to be treated as felonies before, when these cases end up in court, if they do, the judge does not have any leverage to get them treatment. Our drug courts used to be well attended with folks who would go and get drug treatment. Now, when individuals are being sentenced and they have the option to go into drug court to get treatment, they're saying, no, I'll just sentence me and I don't have to go through a burdensome program where the judge is following up on me every week. I come back to court and they're seeing if I'm remaining sober. What Prop 36 would do is say, the third time, you can be charged as a felony. The DA has that discretion. If the DA exercises his discretion improperly or her discretion properly, the judge, when hears that case, can still say, you know what, DA, I think that should be a misdemeanor and not a felony. It has that ability to do that. And then they have the option of drug treatment mandated felonies. And that is, you, with the threat of incarceration, with the threat of prison, the judge can say, participate in treatment. That's what we want. We want you to get better. We don't want you to be an addict. We don't want you to say, just sentence me and, you know, I'll go ahead and go about my business. We want you to be treated for the underlying cause of your addiction by going to drug court or by going to some type of treatment program. And by treating it as a felony, it gives legal leverage to the judge to be able to say, you can either choose incarceration or choose treatment. It's your choice. And it's written into the statutes that says, if they're not, you know, before incarceration is even an option under this law, it has to be that they are not eligible for treatment or not amenable to treatment. So treatment has to be tried first, and there has to be some reason why they cannot go to treatment. And we've seen how drug courts were just decimated after Prop 47 because there was no more legal leverage, and there's been studies done, and I think there's wide conclusions out the state that we have seen our drug courts have just been sick. I think it was the Institute of Court Innovation said, yes, 67% in California of the courts now see their drug courts just basically decimated.
Well, that's what one thing I want to ask you about. I think probably most of us agree that addiction is a disease. And so, like, that being the case, I want to stick with you, Pat. Like, what have you seen? You know, you've been in the DA's office for 30 years. I'm sure you've dealt with people who are addicted to drugs in many different ways. You know, do people just get ready to get sober by knowing that, like, that third thing's coming, that deterrence? Or, you know, or is it something different when their rock bottom is their rock bottom? Like, what was your perception of that? Do you think that will really make a serious difference for addicts, knowing that third thing is coming?
Difficult question. And what we've seen, and my experience with those folks who come through the criminal justice system. So those are the folks who have been charged with a crime and find themselves there. I had the privilege of, when I was years ago in the South Bay branch office of the court system, to be one of the founders who started the drug court in South Bay. And what we saw and what that consisted of is folks who are at their lowest. They're not going to necessarily choose to go to treatment, but there are a population of individuals who have to be forced into treatment. And there's a healthy debate to say, you know, should you force people into treatment? Well, for some individuals who just won't get better, That is the only option. And we've seen people who successfully moved through the drug court program come to drug court graduation, and they've expressed thanks. They've expressed thanks to the judge, to the prosecution, to say, I wouldn't have got better on my own, but for forcing me into this program, and that program made them better. So it's not this, it's not a one-size-fits-all. It's not the same answer for everyone because it's a bunch of individuals. But we have seen the successes, how folks who otherwise would turn their back to treatment but found themselves in the criminal justice system and participated in drug court, got better, and went on a positive path. And so I think that that's a success story. And that's what we're after. It's not a war on drugs. We don't want to go back to that. It's a war on addiction.
Genevieve, what do you think the answer is when it comes to serious addiction in California and the serious drugs we have out on the street? Obviously, you don't think Prop 36 is the answer, but what do you think is the right answer for how we deal with, you know, addiction in the state?
I can tell you that this rhetoric of declaring a war on addiction is exactly why we're in the place that we're in. War on addiction. We have to treat addiction, substance use disorders, as the public health emergencies and crises they are. This rhetoric about declaring war on addiction and putting people into prison or even jail because they have an addiction is preposterous. This is how America as a whole has dealt with addiction. And this is why we are the most carceral nation in the world and why we look the way we look compared to other countries who are less carceral. And what I mean by that is when other countries have taken a different stance and have treated these same issues as public health crises, they don't have the addiction problems we have. And we can do this about every other issue, whether it's gun violence, and see how other countries address it. But this rhetoric of declaring war on addiction is what got us here in the first place. I can tell you that that failed war on drugs we were in, they probably had that same notion. And who did it impact? It impacted communities of color because we got the harsher sentences for things like crack cocaine, and we did not go to the underlying causes. That's the answer. The answer is addressing it like the public health crisis it is, an emergency it is, the way that we're now starting to see compassion around fentanyl use. Did you hear the difference in how we're talking about fentanyl use versus how we would talk about crack cocaine? Right? We need that same compassion on every single level. The second thing is we've got to get out of this idea that somehow we can just incarcerate our way out of problems and not do anything for the complex social issues that are the offspring of what we're seeing. And so Prop 36 for me is not a solution at all because it actually diverts funding from the things that address the root causes. With Prop 47, we got savings of, by the Attorney General's number, $95 million. That's the Attorney General's number for last year. I've seen reports that it was upwards to $113 million in savings in our last fiscal year, and that's the Policy Institute of California with that number. Prop 36 is going to take away the savings that we had from diverting away from our prison system, and where we have been able to use that money for K-12 education, for mental health care, for trauma recovery services for victims and crime survivors. That is where Prop 36 is going to take money from. So how do we solve an issue by creating more dire situations that is only going to feed the same problem that we're saying we're going to address? And that's what Prop 36 does.
Yeah, that's an interesting point you bring up there, Genevieve. What happened with Prop 47 is that any savings the state got from not locking people up so much, that money is required to be spent on things like treatment, and I don't remember the full list, but several other things. And that money obviously is going to be cut into, and so that $95 million is going to be less. presumably it could even be zero or in the other direction. Talk about the money aspect there.
Sure. And what we have to start with, in 2006, there were 137,000 folks in state prison in California. We've seen reforms over the years, so that number has gone down. So it was about 94,000 folks in state prison, I want to say, probably the year before.
Yeah, we were like fourth in the country, and now we're somewhere in the middle, I think, in terms of incarceration rates.
Right. And the LAO, the Legislative Analyst Office, is predicting that that number will continue to go down and be about 90,000, I think, is probably where we expect to be next year. However, add that with, you know, now Prop 36. What will Prop 36 do? So Prop 36 is estimated by LAO will increase the prison population by a few thousand. So that will put us back up to where it was last year. And so the funding is how much is there a prison savings? There will be still a prison savings that will be there for programs. But as Genevieve mentioned, 36 is not in a vacuum. And we passed Proposition 1, in the March or June ballot, I think it was. It will go into effect next year. And that's about almost $7 billion in bonds for facilities that will treat folks who suffer from mental disorders and from substance abuse. And so that's another funding that's potentially out there as well. And so, you know, while it's right to say that Prop 36 does not provide more money, what it does is it's in an environment where there are other sources of revenue that will be there. It does not eliminate the Prop 47 money. The impact will be the measurement of savings from where we were at the beginning to where we are now. There will still be some savings, but it'll be about a few thousand more inmates in prison. It's projected by the LAO.
Will, can I just add this little tidbit? The Attorney General has stated that the savings that we've enjoyed as a result of us passing Prop 47 has been hundreds of millions of dollars. The number that I have is $800 million in savings since Prop 47 became law. The Attorney General has stated that if we vote in Prop 36, the savings will only be maybe tens of millions. So this is an exponential change. And I really want us to understand that it's not just about diverting funds away from things we absolutely need, but there is going to come at a cost to us taxpayers. And is that a cost that we want to take on? And I'm not just talking about a financial cost. I'm talking about human costs as well. And this is what we have to consider when we have something like Prop 36 being pushed in front of us.
Can I just jump in real quick? I'm not going to disagree, but I'd say we've had Prop 47 for, you know, 10 years now. And do we have enough resources now to provide treatment and programs for all those folks who have substance abuse problems who come through the criminal justice system? And sadly, the answer is no. So, you know, what that emphasizes is there still is a need on the part of our policymakers is to divert more resources. And I think that's what they're trying to do with things like Prop 1, and thankfully Prop 36 will operate.
Thank you for indulging me on this.
You know, so this we know that when we try to make laws tougher in this country, that frequently falls on the backs of Black and brown folks. And so, you know, in this case, you know, how does that make you feel about strengthening those laws and like that disparity that's at the heart of our criminal justice system sometimes?
Sure. And part of my job is I go up to Sacramento and I will, you know, advocate on behalf of legislation or oppose legislation. And we see a lot of changes coming out of Sacramento in the last few years. A couple of them, let me talk about the Racial Justice Act. And so Prop 36, if it were to become law, it would operate in an environment where the Racial Justice Act is currently law. What the Racial Justice Act does is if someone says, I was the victim of discrimination, or I, a person of color, I was negatively impacted by this law, the Racial Justice Act is a tool that their lawyers can use and bring on their behalf to say, Judge, let's look at this to make sure race didn't serve an improper reason in the way this person was charged and the ultimate consequence the person received. And so that's That's a protector that we have that's in place in the environment where Prop 36 will act. In addition, we have another reform, and that reform is race-blind charging that will take effect. I think it's either next year or the year after. And what the Race-Blind Charging Act does, it says when police law enforcement submits a case to a prosecutor to review, they can't know the race of that individual. So that has to be redacted out. They have to prepare police reports in such a way that they take out all reference that they could possibly know the race of the person being asked for charges. And so that takes that.
So you feel strongly that this will be implemented equitably?
I think so, yes. I mean, that's the reason when they asked, let's make these changes, it was to address those concerns. And so Prop 36 will operate in that environment.
Genevieve? She was right. No goodness.
Yes, I was. I didn't want to forget what I had to say. There's just so much here. Why can't you make this session 3 hours? My goodness. So I want to say that I sit on the implementation group for the RJA, the Racial Justice Act that Mr. Espinosa just talked about. And I will tell you that San Diego has not granted, not one judge in San Diego has granted an RJA motion in this county. Okay. So I really want us to be clear that things that are being, and I think it's a great tool. I helped write it. Hello. And I want to teach attorneys and continue to teach attorneys how to use it. But I want to say that we don't live in a perfect world. Okay. One thing we know for sure is that Prop 47 has actually narrowed the disparities for racial justice. When you look at arrests and bookings of African Americans, for instance, before and after Prop 47. So that is a tried and true impact that we can point to and say, you know what, the data supports that there has been this change and the disparities are now lessened because of Prop 47. But Mr. Espinosa said something that was very interesting to me, and it was that we don't have enough money right now to support treatment of all these people. Well, what do you think is going to happen if we pass Prop 36? And that is my biggest concern. Again, it's overkill. I think it's unnecessary, but let's think about this. If we already don't have enough money to treat the people we have, then what happens when we actually take away that funding for mental health care, for drug treatment? And so you have less money in the pot. And then you're cycling people in and out of prison. And there's stigma attached to that. You know, the session name is Prop 47, Are Felonies the Answer? I think we all know felonies can never be the right answer because it just gives another obstacle. And the one thing we haven't touched on is this purported solution for homelessness, which Prop 36 does nothing to address homelessness, but that's another issue. But there's all these buzzwords in Prop 36 where they get to say, we're going to help people, and people are going to get into treatment. When we talk about why drug court attendance and participation is down, this is a perfect example of why Prop 47 is the perfect scapegoat for district attorneys and politicians and people who don't want to do their job. I'm going to be very honest with you. Participation in drug court or any court-ordered programs has to be looked at as a complex issue that does not distill down to Prop 47 being the law. We have to look practically at what drug court and programs actually demand and require of participants. One, that they just stop cold turkey. How realistic is that? Do I want to volunteer to go into withdrawal with no help and I'm going to be kicked out of a program or be placed on some sort of censure because I tested dirty, because I used? And we all know that relapse is a part of recovery, right? So when we're talking about why numbers are down in certain programs, Prop 47 is not the reason. The reason could be a slew of other things: how we do the programs, the demands that we make on the participants. Well, there's so much to say. I'll end there. But the problem is that Prop 47 has been scapegoated way too much, and it is not the cause of these issues that Prop 36 actually says it addresses and doesn't. And the last thing I will say on this, Will, is we never give reform a chance. Prop 47 has only been on the books for 10 years. And I'm going to say only, because how long have we been completely punitive? How long have we not been focused on rehabilitation? How long have we been focused on incarcerating our way out of things? How many decades? And we give this 10 years and it's actually proven successful. And now it's time to push the pendulum. And I'm using push the pendulum intentionally, because it's not swinging. They're pushing it into a certain direction. And it is incumbent upon all of us to not let that happen. And that's why we should be no on Prop 36.
Let me ask you about that, Pat. Well, you know, what if we doubled down on treatment instead of going back in the other direction? Like, do you think that could also be an answer?
Well, you know, we've had Prop 47 for 10 years, and the promise was going to be that there was savings, that there were going to be adequate programs. And have we seen those adequate programs? I don't know. What we did see instead was drug courts attendance being decimated. And so the reason that we're seeing from the court perspective is, well, there is no leverage to get folks into our drug court programs. This will potentially be that leverage. And so the hope is that, you know, there is policymakers say we need more programs. We would welcome that, because that the judges could then offer that as a solution. And if not, we have drug court, and then we can hope that Proposition 1 meets its goal and builds facilities and provides more opportunities for treatment for both those who suffer from mental illness and from substance abuse.
Do you agree with what Genevieve said, that what's going on with drugs is a public health crisis?
Well, yes, I think so. But we see there's an intersection with those who suffer, then find themselves also in the criminal justice system. Some of them, we see the folks that are retail thieves often do that because they're feeding an addiction. And so, you know, oftentimes the public health crisis crosses into the criminal justice system, and then it becomes the responsibility of the criminal justice system to come up with ways in which to address that.
Thank you both. We're going to jump into some questions. Thank you all for submitting your questions. I have them here in note cards. But one person is going to get a little special treatment, and that is an Aaron Price fellow who's with us today. They're going to stand up and ask a question. I'm trying to find their name on this paper so I can read it to you. Okay. Here you go. I'm going to actually let you introduce yourself. Sorry.
Hello, my name is Sophia Rosas. I'm a senior at Point Loma High School. Prop 47 has helped to redirect funds away from the prison system and into K-12 schools. How will any revisions to Prop 47 impact the positive effects that it has already had on our education system?
You guys got that?
The impact on the education system? Was that your question? Well, I mean, I could take a stab at it. The way Prop 47 was set up, the funding, a portion of the funding would, I think it was 10% of the funding, would go to the schools and so forth. And so potentially that pot of money that's available to be passed out could be reduced to some degree. How much, we don't know. It depends on what the savings are. So, I mean, it's pretty speculative at this point to be able to predict how much, you know, the budgets are going to be impacted, but we would suspect there'd be some, hopefully minimally.
Do you want to add, Genevieve?
Yes. Thank you, Sophia. When we look at what Prop 47 actually did, it took money away from the prisons and basically from those savings put into three different pots, the schools being one. The first pot, which is the biggest portion of it, was money that would go towards mental health care and things of that nature. And that was 65% of the money. And then you had 10% of the money going to trauma recovery services for crime survivors. And then 25% will go through our K-12 education system. What we saw with the money, what we still see with the money that comes from Prop 47 for our students, is we have more in-support programs for people who we call at risk. I don't necessarily like that term, but for our students who may be struggling in school for whatever reasons because of whatever's happening in school or even at home, their environment. What we know is that Prop 47 has helped to keep our students in school, where school had been a challenge for them. It has supported after school programs and have given our students more opportunities and put them at less risk of being harmed or engaging in harmful activities. And what is going to happen is if Prop 36 is passed, is we are going to see those funds no longer be given to our school system, especially at that level. Obviously, we're going to have some funding that goes to our schools because that's just required under the law. But Prop 47 gives 25% of those savings. And again, we've saved $800 million to the Board of Education to do what it needs to do for our K through 12 students. That is a huge amount of money that we're no longer going to have at our disposable, at our disposal to use for our students. And that is another fear of mine.
So I've got a question here for you, Patrick. I don't know what is going on with the sound, but I apologize. I definitely am not the right person to fix it. I was supposed to give a better intro to the Aaron Price Fellowship. That was our Aaron Price Fellow, Sophia Rosas. And if you've never heard of the Aaron Price Fellows Program, it selects 40 kind, inquisitive, open-minded ninth graders every year from a pool of 300 applicants for a three-year journey. And they go behind the scenes, like right now today, to see how cities function. They explore the role of community members in shaping society. And it's been around since 1991. So yay for Aaron Price Fellows. So Patrick, you mentioned that law enforcement officers are currently resource starved. Wouldn't changing theft to a felony cause resource starvation in other areas or crimes? Why not advocate for increasing law enforcement resources so they can respond instead of this change with Prop 36?
Well, the focus would be on those serial thieves under Prop 36. So it wouldn't be all thieves. It'd be the ones that create the most damage, both to the retailers, to the mom and pop shops, the ones that are a priority and should be a priority. And it was the state auditor 2 months ago in July 2024 that issued a report. And in that, the state auditor of California made a recommendation. The recommendation was that there needed to be a change in Prop 47 so that you can focus on those recidivists who are the folks that commit three or four thefts and just are not deterred. And so, the approach is let's identify those small subset of individuals who are the recidivist thieves that should be the legitimate focus of law enforcement. And so it's not going to be a widespread approach, but one that's much more limited. And I think that's going to be a more strategic approach for law enforcement.
I'm going to go ahead and hop on to the next one and give it to you, Genevieve. Are there provisions in Prop 36 or elsewhere that requires the state to pay for court-ordered drug treatment? If not, doesn't this keep people from actually affording treatment, facing indebtedness, or imprisonment?
So that's actually a really big pitfall and a drawback for Prop 36. There is nothing in the language of the initiative that actually talks about a source of funding for all this mandated treatment. Just think about that. We're going to mandate treatment, but how are we going to fund it? And this goes back to something Mr. Espinosa said earlier. We already don't have the funding to do it. Mayor Steinberg, Mayor of Sacramento, who also used to be in the California State Assembly, talked about how 18 counties in California don't have one single drug treatment bed. So when we started this conversation, we talked about how this is a statewide problem. How can we make it mandatory for counties to give drug treatment and to fund these programs
without a source of the funding?
Where is the money coming from? How is this going to actually work? It's not. This is going to be another mandate from the state that we're not going to be able to fulfill. We don't have the money to do it. So no, there's nothing in that piece of proposed legislation that actually gives a source of funding for drug treatment or homelessness.
We agree. I can just say, I think we're both in agreement here, is there's not the resources to provide beds for everyone who is charged with a drug crime who comes in the court system. But just because there aren't enough funding to provide them beds in a residential treatment facility doesn't mean they should get some treatment. It doesn't mean that they should go to drug court or somehow do something, be ordered by a court to address their underlying condition of substance abuse in some way. And so we will never, as the state of California, with all the obligations we have, be able to find residential treatment in a bed for every individual who has a narcotic problem. That's unrealistic.
To treat everybody in the state, you think it's unrealistic?
To have everybody. A bed for them, to have a residential treatment where you have a place. That does not seem likely to someone, for all the folks that have a drug problem, because the drug problem is so great. But what this would do was it gives them some type of treatment, and that's drug court, then that's the service that'd be available. And we've seen folks who've gone through the drug court system. It's not a bed for them. It's not a residential treatment facility, but it does allow them to address the issues of addiction. And we've seen them get better. We've seen them come back and say,
can you explain a little what drug court is? Y'all both talked about it quite a bit.
Drug court, it's first, if someone was convicted of a drug offense, this is different than where they're ordered in a lockdown bed and, you know, they have to stay there. Drug court would be, you have strict conditions, you can't use, you're tested for use, maybe you have to go to narcotics anonymous classes, you come back, see the judge once a week with your lawyer, with other folks that are in drug court with the judge, and you address those issues of your addiction, you talk about your struggles, and you work with those folks, and they know, I got to go back to court for my weekly court date and address these issues. The court's looking at me. They have law enforcement officers that'll reach out to them and follow up with them during the week, see how they're doing. So that's what
the case is dismissed.
Right, and you get the benefit of the case dismissed. And so what I'm saying, there's not money for treatment. There's not money for residential, you know, in-care treatment for everyone. But that doesn't mean we just ignore that. We don't offer them no treatment at all, because by coming through the court system, and if the court has the ability to say, we need you to participate in the type of treatment we do have, be it drug court or whatever kind of programs can be available, that is still some good, and it's better than the alternative. The alternative is when these folks are coming into court, they're being sentenced on their felony offense, and they're just saying, put me on probation, I'm good, I'm not going to participate in any treatment. And we miss the opportunity to address that underlying problem of addiction that they have.
The missed opportunity is diverting funds away from what would actually fund treatment programs, which is what Prop 47 already provides for. Prop 47 gives funding to nonprofits that engage in recovery work. It gives funding to the courts for recovery programs. So what we're talking about with Prop 36 is taking away that funding and putting it back into our prison system. That's a problem. So whether they need a bed or they can do outpatient treatment, the point and the problem is that we're not going to be able to give the treatment at the level we need under the rubric of Prop 36, because it takes away funding that is vital to support the programs we need to give people the help they need to address the underlying conditions and issues.
What do you think about what Pat said about how it seemed, you know, unlikely that we were going to have all the beds we need for, you know, people who need them in California? Like, does that strike at what you were talking about it, we haven't given Prop 47 enough time?
We absolutely have not. But I think that statement really calls into question what the heck we're trying to do with Prop 36.
What we're trying to do is provide the legal leverage so we can use the resources we had in the past, like drug court, because the alternative is where folks just say, I don't want any treatment at all, isn't appropriate.
Okay, so another question here. Patrick, you referenced serial misdemeanor perpetrators not showing up to hearings and such. Why is your office not prioritizing prosecution of those people to address the sense of crisis people feel right now?
Well, when someone doesn't show up for court, then, you know, we can put a bench warrant in the system. And then, I'm sorry. When someone doesn't show up for court, the way the system should work is that there would be a bench warrant that's put into the system, and that hopefully law enforcement go make an arrest, or when they cross paths with that individual again because another arrest, another contact, you run them up, you see that there's a warrant, and then they can hopefully bring them into the system. Bringing them in the system means booking them in jail, staying in jail till you go to court, because this is if the type of offender that won't show up at court on their own. However, when we're talking about misdemeanors, the jail won't book misdemeanors because as a function of some reforms, AB 109 that we had in 2011, where now our jails are places where felons are being punished instead of prison. So there's not a lot of room for misdemeanors in some of our jails. And so now oftentimes in big cities and big counties, the county sheriff is not booking misdemeanors. If you're charged with a misdemeanor offense, that's deemed as not serious enough where you're going to stay in jail. And so it's this perpetual, like, hopefully they will come to court on their own promise. Even if they're picked up on a warrant, on a misdemeanor warrant, we can't keep them in custody, get them into court. If they're the type of individual that says, I'm going to show up for court on all the future court dates, then yeah. But if they're the folks that they, on their own, if they're homeless or they're out of custody, those are the kind of folks that obviously have a lot of barriers and challenges on getting transportation to come into court and go through all the court process. And that's the challenge.
I know Genevieve wants to respond, but I have a question that I feel like it would be malpractice of me not to ask you, Patrick, is, you know, how aggressively will your office use this law if it passes? The Legislative Analyst's Office has said that part of the cost we'll see is dependent on how prosecutors use the law. Obviously, prosecutors have a lot of discretion in what they charge and the type of plea deals they do. So how aggressively would you use the law?
Well, when you say use the law, we're talking about both the on those committing drug offenses and theft offenses, right? Yeah, I mean, we will look at the individual as we do every case, look at the circumstances of the case, and look at their criminal history and decide, does this person deserve to be charged with a felony or is a misdemeanor all right? And if we make the call and that's the wrong call, we charge someone with a felony, we have what's called a preliminary hearing where you put on evidence. The judge hears the evidence, looks at the individuals, and has the power under this law to say, you know what, I think the DA got it wrong. I think this one should still be a misdemeanor. And so it's that protection that's built into Prop 36.
So do you envision that when it comes to theft, say, when you see a person show up for the third time and the amount they stole is over $950, do you envision that most of the time you're going to go for that felony?
Well, if the amount they stole, you said over 950?
Yeah.
If it was over 950, it would be a felony today.
Sorry. Under 950.
Right. Okay. Yeah. Under 950, again, it would depend upon the circumstances. What I can tell you is that within the city of San Diego that prosecutes misdemeanor theft cases, we estimate there were probably about 500 cases that were prosecuted as misdemeanors in the city attorney's office that likely would be evaluated by the DA's office for potential filing.
500.
Yeah.
And so you all would consider that 500 each individually is what you're saying?
Yes.
Genevieve, I want to let you get in there before we run out of time.
I just want to say hogwash. Hogwash. Y'all mean to tell me that if the district attorney's office or the city attorney's office ask the judge to issue a bench warrant, and that bench warrant is executed, right? And we're talking about a serial thief, right? This is the context. That somehow they're going to be able to get out of jail when there's a bench warrant that they're being held on, that's not how it works. They would be held in custody until their appearance in court, because that is what secured their presence in court, and then they would have to answer to it, they would be arraigned, and then it would be in the system. There is no world in which we live, especially not in San Diego County, where a person can bail out in a bench warrant, because there's going to be no bail. Now, I really want to make sure we understand this, because the broader context to all this is the lack of will. I'm sorry, Will, but it's a lack of will. They have a point to prove. This is why they're not showing up when they're being called. This is why they're not making it a priority to actually go and get those people, because they want to complain. They want to say, we have to do something about Prop 47, and I can't pick up these people who are not showing up to court. And so they just keep going to Walgreens, and they keep going to CVS, and they keep thieving. There's something you can do. And the issue is that they're not leveraging the law as they can and as they should. I will repeat it again. District attorneys right now can take a person who has been involved in crime sprees, even if they're all under $950, and put them into one case and make it grand theft if there is a common scheme, plan, whatever. And I also want to say, Prop 47 has nothing to do with organized retail theft crime. That has never been a part of Prop 47. We have the legislation. We have legislation about that, that the governor just signed. But I also want to just put that myth to rest. This is not why we have this surge of organized retail theft. It's not because of Prop 47. But no, the answer is they're not leveraging the tools they have at their disposal right now because they want excuses to repeal and roll back Prop 47.
Patrick, we're pretty much out of time, but I do want to give you a quick chance to respond.
I appreciate that. And what Ms. Jones-Wright doesn't appreciate is the radical changes we've seen in the area of bail law in light of Humphreys and so forth. The ability to get no bail is non-existent with the exception of like your LWOP murders and things like that. They have, you know, in the post-Humphrey cases, we just don't see that. That's the reality. And I don't know how frequently you handle those type of cases, but it's been a radical change in the last 3 years in some of these post-Humphrey cases that we've seen. And so that's, I think, contributing to the problem. Also, during the pandemic, they had what's called zero bail, which I'm sure you're familiar with. They just said, you're out. You know, you can't stay in jail. These folks would be arrested. They're out that door because at that time, the idea was let's keep the jail population down. And so that's been a real problem with our ability to.
But that was not Prop 47.
Right. You're right. That was not Prop. That was during the pandemic.
Oh, we'll end on agreement. Yeah. Good job. Thank you so much, y'all. That was awesome. I had a really great time. You were great. Y'all were great. Thank you so much.
Thank you, everybody, for joining us. The next session starts at 11:30, so you have a little time to break, use a restroom, do what you need to do. If you enjoyed our session, you can sign up for our weekly newsletters at voicesofsandiego.com. And thank you again to our sponsors and wonderful volunteers. Enjoy the rest of the summit.